and globally at WPVMFM.org.
This is WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. Hello and welcome to A Better World on WPVM. It's Sunday, January 29th, 2023. My name is McNair Ezard and I'm your host for today's show. We come to you every Sunday morning at 103.7 on your FM dial, or you can stream us at WPVMFM.org. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations, locally, nationally, and internationally, who are working to create a world that works for everyone. A Better World features interviews with people who are making a difference. And today, we are doing a show about Extinction Rebellion, and we are going to be talking to Riley Polka. She's with Extinction Rebellion, Washington, D.C. Riley is a 27-year-old climate activist and organizer in Washington. An Indiana native, she's been invested in climate issues from a very young age, but it wasn't until she moved back to the state for college in 2013 and she saw how climate change impacted farmers in the region that she began thinking about ways to do something about it. Currently, she organizes for Extinction Rebellion DC, which is part of a global nonviolent movement dedicated to stopping business as usual in order to convince governments to finally act on the climate crisis. Riley, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
In case people aren't aware of what Extinction Rebellion is about, can you give me a bit of a background about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So Extinction Rebellion was founded in the UK, that's known as XRUK, in 2018. It was conceptualized much earlier than that in 2017 by a Welsh farmer and sociologist, Roger Hallam. But it wasn't until October of 2018 that they staged their first action. And it was brought about in response to international inaction on the climate crisis in order to stop business as usual, as you said earlier, and get immediate action on the issue. So what they did is they thought that they would maybe block a few streets and get a dozen of people, but their first action gained, there were hundreds of people there, and it was like a week after they had thousands of people in the streets, and from there just completely spread across the globe.
And what year was that that it started in the UK?
2018.
Okay, so it's a fairly new organization, isn't it?
Yeah.
And were there specific cities in the US where the initial group started?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of a tie between us and New York City, us being DC. And I think depending on who you ask, you might get a different answer. But we started in Washington, DC. We believe ourselves to be the first chapter in the United States in November of 2018. And that's when we put on a mock People's Assembly as our first action, which I can get into later, and had our first arrests in the name of getting attention to the climate crisis.
So what was it specifically about Extinction Rebellion that attracted your attention as opposed to any other environmental organization?
You know, they were there. I'd heard about them a little bit. So the media loves to give Extinction Rebellion a bad rap, especially like fossil fuel funded media like CNN. There's some conservative media in the UK that does the same. And I've seen that kind of negative reviews leading up to it. But when I got here, they were working in coalition with another organization called Shutdown DC, which is kind of an umbrella organization that kind of helps uplift other activists' messages in the city. They just had a great social media presence. And when I went and joined them one morning before work for my first protest, they were incredibly welcoming, incredibly receptive, and I just felt very comfortable in the organization.
Mm. Now, I mentioned in the intro that you organized for Extinction Rebellion. Tell me a little bit more about your role with them.
Yeah, so in the last 3 years, I've done quite a few things. I worked on the media and messaging team, writing talking points for interviews like this. I still write the weekly newsletter and send that out, and I coordinate the team of people that help me write that and edit it. I've been an art coordinator, so I've built part of a model row home and sunk it in the tidal basin, which is a famous body of water here in the district for anybody not familiar, in order to get attention to, at the time, pending terrible climate legislation that was going to do more harm than good. And quite a few other things about like outreach and stuff like that. But right now I'm mostly trying to regenerate, get a little bit more energy for the next year. So I've taken a little bit of a step back and I'm just writing the newsletter, doing a little bit of press work and doing some kind of background work.
Yeah, it sounds like your degree in journalism comes in handy.
Yeah, definitely does.
I think a lot of us feel like we, meaning humanity, are not moving quick enough to avert really an irreversible environmental disaster, and that we've basically run out of time to react, like in small steps kind of thing. But I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that. Are we running out of time? Do we need some big global actions, or are small steps going to be okay?
I think you're exactly right. We have run out of time to act in small steps. In the 70s, when this issue first got brought to Congress, we had time to act. We had time to act in small steps. In the 80s, when scientists and politicians were creating climate models for what the climate was going to look like today and trying to predict how quickly the Earth would warm, we still had some time to act, even in the early 90s. In the past 10 years, we have run out of time to act incrementally. Business as usual is killing us. It's killing life on Earth. It is sentencing humans to an impending heat death, a very, very difficult future. And the media and the government are ignoring it. They are washing over it. We don't have time to act incrementally anymore. We need collective action now in order to do something to preserve what left of a future we have.
And I would think you are, specifically your organization in Washington, you're in kind of an influential part of the country. So if you make a statement there, I would think it's more likely to be heard.
We are in an influential part of the country, but I want to really like iterate that it doesn't matter where you are. If you care about the climate and there's a few of you who want to do something about it, no change is too small. If you're interested in collective action and you're in a rural area, there are things you can do. I mean, farmers are being taken advantage of in my home state by corporations, and they're being affected by the climate crisis. And there are plenty of creative things that people can do to call action to those issues and get news coverage of it. Yeah, I mean, in Minnesota, yeah?
No, I was going to say thank you for that. I think that's important for people to know.
If we work together, collective action is really where it's at. And even if you're feeling disenfranchised, yeah, no act is too small. If you care, we're all terrified. I don't know anyone who's not secretly very, very scared of the climate crisis. Talking about it with others is a great first step, but yeah, no act is too small, and it doesn't matter where you are.
I was looking at the organization's website before the show, and I saw something on there called the Demands of Extinction Rebellion. I'm wondering if you could talk about that, please.
Yes. So in the United States, we have four demands, and we're a global organization. We are interconnected, but we're not reliant on each other. So some chapters in other countries have demands that suit their needs. We have four that suit our needs as Americans. And those are tell the truth, act now, just transition, which is our fourth demand, and beyond politics.
Tell me a little bit about the go beyond politics.
So beyond politics is a way to confront the crisis of democracy that we find ourselves in. I think people all over the world are dealing with this. In the States especially, we definitely have a crisis of democracy. And beyond politics means two things. It means that, one, we're looking to implement a citizens assembly. So the only way that we're going to get proper solutions to the climate crisis that are going to serve the people who need it most are by listening to the people who need it most, and that's a direct democracy. So that comes in the form of a citizens assembly, and we're not looking at partisan issues. We're not trying to, it's no one party's fault. There's definitely a lot of blame that can go around for everybody. But it's beyond politics at this point. This is a life or death situation. Mm-hmm. Business as usual is what's killing us. And then the other part of that is we need everybody regardless of your politics. So it's really not about what your political standpoint is. It's just about if you're interested in having a future.
I find it especially interesting, the one tell the truth, because there has been so much disinformation over the years from a lot of the, especially a lot of the big corporations, about the damage that their actions are doing to the environment. So I think that's a really important one.
Yeah. So tell the truth, our first demand. We demand that corporations, the government and corporations, tell the truth about the full extent of the climate crisis. And what that looks like is the government not dilly-dallying in Congress anymore and actually telling the people what's going to happen, what food shortages are going to look like in the future, dealing with the mass displacement that the climate crisis is already causing, that it's going to cause. What it also looks like is mainstream media, I know it's a very fraught term, but mainstream media covering the climate crisis the way it deserves. It's an emergency. We are in a state of emergency, and the media needs to declare that emergency. They need to cover the climate crisis every day, put it on the front page. People need to understand what's at stake here.
And, you know, you spoke about regenerative culture as one of the, when you were talking about demands. What does that mean?
When you're an activist, it is very tiring. You wear your heart on your sleeve. It's a lot. And having a regenerative culture means building a community that you can pass the baton onto if it's too much. If you're carrying too much of a load in the organization, we ask that you pass it on to somebody else, that you speak up about it. It also means that we care for each other and that we try to treat each other in a way that is regenerative and conducive to continuing this work. It's really hard to do so without it. So we try to practice understanding with each other to the best of our ability. We all come from very different backgrounds in both in my chapter, but also like just around the world. So understanding those differences in ideologies and backgrounds is really important to having a massive group of volunteers collectively act for the better good.
Approximately how many volunteers do you have that take part in actions in Washington?
Oh gosh, it changes from time to time. I mean, sometimes we'll have an action and it'll just be about five of us going out there and doing something that might look a little bit silly in the moment, but gets a whole lot of media attention moving forward. Other times we'll get, you know, 30, 40, 50 people out in the street. I wasn't there for it. I was still in the Midwest during it, but when they shut down the city in 2018, there were hundreds of people in the street.
Have you yourself ever been arrested?
I have not. I typically am a press liaison or I'm helping transport stuff. So I have had a green roll, but I have a lot of friends who've been arrested. And if you have the privilege to do so, it's not all, how do I say it? I have not been arrested. I know pretty much everyone in my social circle has. And a lot of those people are like mothers with kids. One of my friends, because we organize together, she's 16. She's an organizer. She's super cool. And she actually went for a red roll. And that means somebody who's willing to get arrested recently. And both she and her mom were in it together for that. It's pretty cool.
Who do you think is responsible for where we're at now with regards to the environmental crisis? Is it our systems to blame, like our political system, our economic system? Is it just big industry? I mean, I know you don't organization doesn't like to shame and blame, but what do you see as the key system problem that we have?
Yeah, I think you could frame it in so many ways that you can look at any one system that we have in the States, economic, social, housing issues. They're all intertwined for sure. It's definitely our systems at hand. It's also definitely a number of very greedy people throughout our history who helped either who took money from the American Petroleum Institute, from other fossil fuel lobbyists, and used their standing as a politician to make climate change seem like a political issue when it's really not. It's a matter of life and death. But I would say for the most part, well, not for the most part, but one that I focus on more is the exploitative economic system that we live under. Capitalism is not good for human health. A stat that I've just had like running around my head recently has been of I guess I just recently learned this because I'm 27, so I'm learning more about insurance. And I didn't know that if you crash your car, that that is considered good for the economy, because it means that you're going to be stimulating the economy by buying a car at some point in the future. And I think that's just such a good, like, such good imagery for how terrible the economy that we live under is for us, because I can't imagine a friend crashing their car and saying, oh my gosh, you're so patriotic, good on you, I'm so happy you crashed your car, thanks for stimulating the economy, when I can't even afford to buy fresh food at the store because of how expensive it is. Yeah. So it's these exploitative capitalist systems that prioritize stealing land from indigenous people, like what's happening in Minnesota right now with Enbridge Corporation building a pipeline under sacred indigenous land, destroying their drinking water. Most of Enbridge's pipelines spill at some point, by the way, and stealing that from indigenous people when it's their land in the name of wealth. So the rich, I mean, as we all know, like, the rich have gotten so rich during the pandemic, but the rich keep getting richer. The poor and what used to be the middle class keep getting poorer. And so, yeah, it's, I tend to look at capitalism, but it is a lot of things, but mostly greed.
I appreciate your sensitivity to those issues. And just to ask, I mean, if capitalism is part of the problem, what do you see? Is there a system that exists in the world today that is better for what Extinction Rebellion is advocating, to more equality and so on?
Well, I mean, I guess I'd have a few caveats with that. Well, maybe not a caveat, but XR, so that's what we colloquially call it, is XR. We don't typically advocate for any one solution, because one of the solutions we're advocating for is to implement a citizens' assembly, direct democracy, hearing from the people most at risk of being harmed and most harmed already. But I mean, in the States, we white people really benefit from white supremacy, and capitalism has the capitalism we live under benefits from systems of white supremacy. The wealth in this nation, white people were able to build wealth very early on because of slavery and because of how we handled the Reconstruction period was handled, preventing Black people and people of color and immigrants from building wealth. So I do think that there needs to be a major shifting of values, and that everybody deserves access to clean air, to clean drinking water that doesn't have microplastics in it. And I think we can do that equitably. I think everybody, you know, farmers deserve to continue farming their generation farms. Indigenous people deserve their land back. Like, we need to give land back. There's so much that goes into it. I don't think I have the solution. I don't think my chapter has the solution, but just trying to live equitably and understand the privilege that I have and can definitely help shape my worldview. So I guess it's a shifting of worldviews that will eventually shift the systems, but I don't think I can speak to what that would look like.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Riley Polka with the Extinction Rebellion DC. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM FM in Asheville, North Carolina. Burn by the fire we make. Burn by the fire we make. What a shame. And the wind gave in. And the rain in our season. And the sun came to beat. On a land of sand and diseases. And when God looked down on the earth and saw it was broken, then the tears of God. And that's Burned by the Fire We Make by Adrian Belew. That's from his Here album. Riley, let me ask you, previous shows I've had environmental groups, and a lot of them focus on relationship building with either politicians or other organizations and so on. Where does Extinction Rebellion, are you interested in relationship building?
Extinction Rebellion's not disinterested in relationship building with politicians, but again, business as usual is what's killing us. And the politicians in power right now are mostly representative of business as usual. We do believe that anybody interested in making a change has a part in the movement. So there are other organizations, I think Sunrise Movement is one, for example, who do focus on more relationship building, but Extinction Rebellion's really good at acting as the canary in the coal mine. So what that means is we're here in the streets doing what looks to be doing big actions. We're very colorful. We're very artistic. We will shut down streets to, you know, stop business as usual, et cetera. And that can sometimes help others get their foot in the door when they're trying to have conversations on climate issues that maybe they wouldn't have been able to have otherwise. And we do look to speak to our local politicians before we begin engaging in nonviolent direct action, which is what we do. We're a nonviolent direct action organization. So we have reached out to our local government before and said, hey, this policy that you're trying to enact is going to kill us. Can we talk about this? But typically they're taking money from fossil fuel lobbyists. And they're not really interested in talking when we're not willing to pay them. So then we practice NVDA, nonviolent direct action, in order to get that change.
I was going to ask you about this later, but let me go ahead and ask you, talk about some of the actions that Extinction Rebellion DC has been involved in.
Yes, so we do a lot of different things. We're known for closing streets, which may be a controversial thing. If you're listening right now, especially if you're a listener in the car, you probably don't want to be stopped in traffic, but it's actually pretty effective to getting attention to an issue. And nonviolent direct action is historically one of the best ways for getting social change. It's a lot of what equal rights in this country were built on, is nonviolent direct action. So I've been a part of certain actions, like we built a model row home in DC. Most of our houses are called row homes. It's a very popular East Coast type style home. And we built the top half of one. We copied this action that they did in the UK, which was really brilliant, where they built a house and they floated it down the Thames. Mm-hmm. We built a model row home and we sunk it in the tidal basin. So we floated it on some boat docks. So it looked like it was sinking. And we had a big banner and a person in there who ended up getting arrested for it. But it was to call attention to pending climate legislation that was going to favor fossil fuels. We have made massive, massive banners, huge colorful banners that we've scaled our city council building when we're in this campaign right now to get them to pull out of pumping more methane into the district. We scaled the building and dropped a massive banner off of it that read no new fossil fuels and had a big street party in front of it. And that actually got global coverage. That was picked up by Rolling Stone in coverage of protests and even made it to the Washington Post, quite a few different outlets. But other things, we try to do very fun, creative, artistic things that are nonviolent and that are inviting and intriguing to the press so that they'll actually do what you're doing and cover the crisis.
Have you had a favorite action that you've participated in?
Oh gosh. I mean, if the row home was a labor of love, that was something that I'd been wanting to do for a year. So when I was able to, that was pretty great. Figuring out how to build something that you could collapse and then put back together and sink and float. That was very exciting. They're all great. I think that we were doing some really great stuff where we were going to city council meetings last year to ask them why they were allowing this public utility company, Washington Gas, to pump put $4.5 billion worth of money into adding more methane to the district. And so we had people who would dress in hazmat suits and actually ended up getting recognized in an elevator once, one of my friends, because one of the city council guys saw him and said, hey, aren't you that methane guy? And about 20 minutes later, we ended up on their live stream of the thing, because of course we were there to interrupt the meeting, but it got really good coverage. And now we're finally hearing people talk about the risks of methane on the air in DC. We've been putting in so much work and it's really been paying off. Other organizations are able to get the word out now.
Are you knowledgeable enough about methane issue? What's going on? Can you kind of give me a brief synopsis of what's happening in DC with that?
Yeah. So in, I think it was 2018, the mayor, Mariel Bowser, and city council passed legislation saying that they were going to cut climate emissions in the district and they were going to work on electrifying the city. Pretty clear cut. And that was actually like, that was great. That was good. A little bit below what we needed. It wasn't as immediate. They were going to do it by, I think, 2023, I guess it was by this year. And Washington Gas is the gas company in the district. And most of our homes are heated by natural gas here and our stoves are natural gas. It's a highly potent gas. And when it comes out of your stove, it's also mixed with a bunch of other toxic gases that cause childhood asthma. About 12.5% of childhood asthma cases are estimated to come from exposure to methane gas inside the home. So it's always good to ventilate if you cook with a methane gas stove. But Washington Gas is putting $4.5 billion into renovating the pipe system in the district in order to continue pumping methane into our homes. There's no end in sight for them. They don't plan on quitting. And the people who are on the board responsible for judging whether or not Washington Gas is allowed to do that, that they're on the Public Service Commission in our city, and that's a non-elected group of government officials. The majority of them are former Washington Gas board members. So it's very obvious that there's money involved here that is leading the city council to kind of turn a blind eye to this. And methane heats the atmosphere 80 times faster or more potently than carbon dioxide does because it has a shorter life and it's a much more intense life. So in DC, where we have a lot of income inequality, we've noticed that there's studies that have come out. People who live in richer neighborhoods, they're typically white, who live in these richer neighborhoods, they have a lot more trees, they have a lot more foliage. And when there's a gas leak there, that gas leak gets fixed right away. But in the poorer neighborhoods, which typically tend to be Black or Hispanic and are much lower, or lower income, the poorer neighborhoods, they have much less foliage. When methane escapes into the ground, it kills those trees. It's a whole thing. So we've been running this campaign to stop Washington Gas from doing so. And we're saying, look, put that $4.5 billion into electrifying the city. You don't have to necessarily lose money here. Just do something good for the people instead of continuing to make us sick and continuing to heat the city to where we have unbearably hot days and we can't even go outside.
Well, you'd mentioned about people that are lower on the economic scale. I mean, it seems like the poor and the poverty-stricken are usually the ones that are suffer the consequences more readily than, not readily, but more severely than people who have the economic means.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that makes it easy for people with the economic means to ignore the issue. But if you look around, anybody listening to the people in your life who are having a harder time, maybe who are less advocated for and see how government works for them, that's how the climate crisis is going to affect them as well. Mm-hmm. Poor people, Black people, poor Black families especially, Indigenous people whose land we've stolen and continue to steal to build fossil fuel, like pipelines on, women of color are all going to be most susceptible to the climate crisis. And so what that could mean is, like in Hurricane Katrina, look at who got the most aid and who didn't get the most aid. It was typically white people who got the most positive news coverage. Black people got really negative news coverage, even if they were doing the same thing. And when it came to displacement, it was poor Black women who were finding themselves shipped off to Texas, to suddenly going from living in a home in Louisiana to Texas, where they don't know anybody, have no resources, and have to beg on the streets for food and diapers for their kids. That's what the effects of the climate crisis are going to look like. And those are the people it's going to affect.
And of course, underlying all of that, you have the system of racism, which is existent in this country as well, which shows itself at times like that.
Yes, absolutely. It's systemic, I don't know how qualified I am to speak on it, but it's one of the biggest factors into the disparities of why the climate crisis does not affect people on an equal opportunity scale. Mm-hmm. It's something that needs to be changed immediately and challenged.
How is XR different from the work being done by other environmental activist groups, say like Earth Justice, Greenpeace, Sea Shepherd, those kind of groups?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're still pretty new for one, so I think that changes how funding works out, but we primarily practice nonviolent direct action. I know Greenpeace does as well, and I'm not wholly familiar with like with all of the groups that you listed necessarily, but we are very colorful. We have a style guide. If you see an Extinction Rebellion action, you'll recognize it right away. But our principles and our demands are what set us apart. So we're not just environmentalists. We're worried about the extinction of the human race as well. We're here to rebel against the sixth mass extinction. So I think that specificity is kind of what sets us aside there.
So yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. What does sixth mass extinction mean?
Well, it's what we're currently going through. Mm-hmm. And as it implies, the Earth has seen five other extinctions in its history. And what that is if anyone doesn't know, it's when a bunch of life dies off, especially the agrobiodiversity dies off in what was considered a short period of time. But a short period of time there could have meant thousands of years, like the Ice Age. The sixth mass extinction has been occurring since the Industrial Revolution, since we really started putting burning fossil fuels for energy and emitting fossil fuel carbon emissions into the air. And we have seen a decline in life on Earth since then so rapidly that it's become the sixth mass extinction, essentially. I'm not quite sure how to say that any more eloquently, mm-hmm. but it's called the Anthropocene extinction. And it is completely man-made. In fact, it was really interesting. I was reading this book, Losing Earth by Nathaniel Rich. It's a very easy read, very good. And it covers like the 10-year span between the late 70s and the very early 90s when we actually had a chance in the United States to do something about the climate crisis. And it covers how that all got foiled. And one of the things that Nathaniel Rich says is that in the research he did, he found documents from the late 1800s of a chemist who had predicted back then that carbon emissions would affect the climate of the Earth and warm it to a degree that it would make life very difficult for humans on Earth.
He was ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, ahead of his time, but we've known. Yes.
Yeah. You're listening to A Better World on 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. And we'll return with our guest, Riley Polka from Extinction Rebellion, in just a few minutes after this musical break.
The dams, stand up to oil, protect the plants and renew the soil. Who's gonna stand up and save the earth? Who's gonna say that she's had enough? Who's gonna take on the big machine? Who's gonna stand up and save? Fracking now, let's save the water and build a life for our sons and daughters. Who's gonna stand up and save the earth? Who's gonna say that? who's gonna take on the big machine? Who's gonna stand up and save the earth? This all starts with you and me. Starve the takers and feed the givers. Let's build the green, let's save the world. We're the people known as Earth. Who's gonna stand up and save the earth? Who's gonna say that she's had enough? Who's gonna take on the big machine? Who's gonna stand up and save the earth? This all starts with you and me.
Okay, that's Neil Young singing Who's Gonna Stand Up? And that's from his Down to Earth album. You're listening to WPVM 103.7 FM, and this is A Better World. And today we are talking to Riley Polka. She's a 27-year-old climate activist and organizer in Washington, D.C. An Indiana native, she's been invested in climate issues from a very young age, but it wasn't until she actually moved back to her state of Indiana for college in 2013, and she saw how climate change impacted farmers in the region. And then she began thinking about ways to do something about it. Currently, she organizes for Extinction Rebellion DC, which is part of a global nonviolent movement dedicated to stopping business as usual in order to convince governments to finally act on the climate crisis. Well, Riley, we're in the second half of the show, and I wanted to start it off by asking you about Extinction Rebellion and how do you prioritize, or I guess, first of all, how do you come up with the subjects for your action and how do you prioritize among competing issues?
Well, it depends on a few things. We are entirely volunteer-led, and we have a really wide demographic of people involved. So that means that we have a lot of people with different knowledge and interests in the organization. That tends to guide the issues that we find ourselves involved in or protesting. You really need energy to do something, right? So we try and follow the energy. But then when it does come to putting together a protest or putting together an action, we look at a few things. What's going to make it the most newsworthy? What's going to get coverage of this action? What's going to get coverage of it in the parts of the paper that we want it covered in? What press are going to be interested in that action? Is it something that we're going to want to get people arrested for? Is that going to aid in getting that coverage? We tend to look both locally and globally because we're an international movement. We especially understand the international scope of the climate crisis. It's maybe hard not to, but we also try to look locally. So I think I mentioned before running this campaign on getting methane out of the district right now. And that's something that's both very relevant at the moment because Washington Gas is undergoing their project right now as I speak. It's also something a lot of people have been talking about already. A lot of public health officials have been pretty nervous about methane recently, and a lot of papers were coming out. So the timing's good there. But it's also something that we know we can win. We know that the public's on our side with that. And a small win is really important to gaining momentum for bigger wins. So that's a little bit of why we chose to do it. But it's something we all care about. And it's a major climate justice issue because of the intense disparity of who's affected by methane gas emissions. And being a climate justice organization, those tend to be the issues that we look at the most.
Being in Washington, are you not specific politicians so much, but, you know, the last election and before that, there was a lot made of Green New Deal and the politicians that were advocating for that. What do you think about such a thing as an idea as the Green New Deal?
Well, I think that the original New Deal was a great thing, especially being from Indiana. The school that I went to was all built by people who were able to get jobs from the New Deal. And I think creating jobs is very important right now. But as far as it being the solution to the climate crisis, it may be a stepping stone. But what we need is immediate, dire action on the crisis and not really something that's going to take a few years to implement, et cetera. We really need just immediate policy now. But what that looks like, I don't think I'm too qualified to speak on.
Do you think there's a certain level of complacency that exists in society towards the environmental crisis that we're facing?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think it's really scary to think about extinction. I mean, it's like trying to think of a really large number. Our brains just aren't really handled to think about those things. You might get it in the form of anxiety, you know, it might channel through you, but in terms of conceptualizing human extinction or a future where you have to ration your water when you've never had to do that before in your life, that's really hard to think about. So it's much easier to be complacent, especially when we have so much new technology, so many distractions in life, and when the work week is so long, and for the most part across the board, Americans are pretty underpaid and overworked, it's very difficult to care about something beyond the next day. If you're more concerned about where you're going to get childcare from tomorrow and where you're going to get your groceries, how you're going to get your groceries and getting to work if your car doesn't work, you're not going to care about carbon emissions. There's no reason for you to. And that is understandable. But we're seeing that on with our politicians as well. And I think that complacency maybe comes a little bit more from greed, like Joe Manchin, for example, who is very interested in offshore drilling while West Virginia is a landlocked state. Not entirely sure what the interest for West Virginia there is outside of Joe Manchin getting a lot of money from fossil fuel lobbyists. Mm-hmm. So I think when you get to the, you know, political level, you're seeing people complacent because of greed. And when you get to the middle class and lower income levels, you're seeing people complacent because we're too tired to care. Like, it's really hard to care about something that you can't even really think about. Mm-hmm. But I assure you that the, you know, climate crisis is real and it is coming. And mm-hmm. if we can start thinking about it and the media can start covering, does finally start covering the way that it needs to, we can do something about it. It's much, much scarier to deal with something you haven't thought about. So I urge anybody who's trying to suppress those feelings to talk about mm-hmm. them, start normalizing it, and mm-hmm. join collective action.
I hate to say it, but it seems like the older generation is not kind of clued up as much as the younger generation is towards this crisis. Why do you think that is? I mean, everybody stands to lose by it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it could be anything. I will say that there are a number of people in the movement who are of the older generation. I mean, some of our best activists, there's a woman, I think she's in her 70s. I'll have to check with her after this call. She is just the best. And I think she moved from Asheville. She used to live there. Now she lives kind of close to me in here in DC. So we do have people who are concerned. I couldn't tell you what it is, but I know, you know, people do tend to mellow out a little bit as we age. And I think a lot of attitude I get from older people is, oh, I'm so glad that the youth are doing something about it. And all I can ever think and sometimes say back is like, you know what? Maybe if you had done something, I wouldn't have to be spending all of my free time doing something about it. Because I guarantee you, the last thing I want to be doing is thinking about what my future will never look like and what it has to look like mm-hmm. because of fossil fuels, because of the ignorance and inaction from our politicians.
If the older generation would have done something, then the younger generation wouldn't be having to suffer the consequences right now.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not just parents. It's not, you know, but it's our politicians. It's the people who are in power when they knew what was happening, what was coming. It's the people who, the climate denialists, who are only climate denialists because of the money that they are getting. It's that older generation. So I'm not talking about anybody's parents necessarily, you know. There was plenty of activism in the 60s and 70s for sure, and that's how we got a lot of good climate legislation passed. But we've known since the 70s that ExxonMobil knew since the 70s, and that's why people think carbon footprints are a real thing that have anything to do with the climate crisis, because ExxonMobil has put so much money into making people think that it's their fault when it's Exxon's fault for how much they pollute.
Are there particular people for you in terms of hero or heroine who is an environmental activist who stands out for you?
There's a few. Really, it's my peers. It's the women that I organize with who I'm stressed out. I work 5 days a week, and my days off are Wednesday and Thursday, but I work 10 to 7. But it's I know two different moms who work full time and have young kids, and they still put in so much time working on this issue. It's just all the other people in my chapter and in the greater activist community who are doing something about it. It's the activists in Atlanta right now who are defending an indigenous forest against police who are calling them terrorists for being environmental activists. It's entirely skewed. There's so much propaganda. It's the indigenous people whose land is being stolen in Minnesota right now because of Line 3. All the people in Appalachia who are dealing with the Mountain Valley Pipeline. It's anybody standing up to it, I see as being very heroic. It's getting
to the point. You're listening to a conversation with Riley Polka. Riley is with Extinction Rebellion in Washington, D.C. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 FM, WPVM. This program comes to you every week on WPVM, and we stream live at WPVMFM.org. Okay, that's Jimmy Cliff singing Sooner or Later from his Struggling Man album. And our guest today is Riley Polka. Currently, she organizes for Extinction Rebellion. Riley, we're back at the last quarter of the show, and I wanted to start by asking you how do you yourself keep motivated to do this work?
Well, I have a lot of outlets to talk about it. Talking about what I'm scared of really helps, and I have a lot of peers doing it. There's also seeing activists get stuff done, like the thousands of people who gathered in Germany a couple weekends ago to protest a coal mine that's being put in there. That's really, really inspiring. And I also know, just based on history, that if we can get enough people to mobilize, to act in unity for our future, for this shared interest of life on this planet, against corporate interests, against the rich, that we can get something done. I see so many people bring ideas into action and make it work. I know that we can do something about this. It's just a matter of stepping up to the plate to do it.
I meant to follow up on an earlier thing you talked about, and I wanted to do that before we get to the end of the show. And you had mentioned several times about citizens' assemblies. What's the purpose of those, and how do they play a role in helping the work that Extinction Rebellion does?
So a citizens' assembly is a form of direct democracy that it's actually been enacted in a couple other countries around the world and to great success. It's a way to hear directly from the people most affected by an issue. You can think of it like a town hall. Right now, we have a crisis of democracy, both in how divided we are politically, but also in how people are represented. That California is only represented by a few people when it has so much land, those people's interests will never be fully represented in Congress. it doesn't really make sense. What we need is we need the people most impacted by the climate crisis. We need to hear their voices in order to figure out what those solutions are. So that's what a citizens assembly is. And that's what we're saying, you know, when we do start looking for solutions, that's what our government needs to implement, our citizens assemblies, to listen to the people who are dealing with food shortages, who are dealing with homelessness because of a natural disaster spurred by the climate crisis, who are being sued by Monsanto because a soybean grew on their land and now Monsanto has taken their farm and a generation farmer is out of work. We need to hear from those people for what the solutions to their problems are.
One thing I saw on the website, maybe you know about it, maybe you don't, is the ongoing Extinction Rebellion educational programs. One is the weekly Heading for Extinction talk. Is that something you can address?
Yes. So anyone's welcome to attend those. If you've listened to this conversation and you're interested, you can go to xrdc.org and sign up for one. You don't have to be interested in joining the organization, but I used to organize those actually and help give those talks all around town. I think I may have even given a couple at one point in time. And that's a rundown of the most recent climate science. It kind of explains basically why what's happening is happening. And then it goes into how social change comes about. And we look at different examples of social change throughout history and why collective action was able to create that social change and how we can get collective action here in the States against the climate crisis.
So what kind of response when you've given talks, what kind of response do you get from the public?
Oh, we get great response. So typically we'll advertise them by putting up posters all over, and then I'll go and hand out flyers somewhere. I've in the past worked a lot of farmers markets, handing out flyers. And we get a lot of people who feel relief at finding a community that is as scared as they are and is doing something about it. We get a lot of people join the organization because it is an outreach tool. But again, if you're interested in learning about it, feel free to join. It doesn't have to be for outreach purposes. It's very good reception. And I think generally it's relief and community that we get out of that.
You mentioned earlier too about part of the work of Extinction Rebellion is nonviolent direct action. And I know you guys provide training in that. Talk to me about that and what happens during that training.
Yeah, so that's another very community-oriented training. We teach both on tactics on how do you safely blockade a street? How do you safely interact with the police? When should you talk to the police, if ever, and who should do that? How do you become a police liaison? We give trainings on that. We give trainings on how to speak to the press at those. And we share our principles of nonviolence. It's not okay to hurt people, and that's not what we're here to do. We're here to disrupt business as usual and get immediate change on the climate crisis. So we help people gain the tools that they need through that, and connect them with a community of other concerned activists who are working on climate justice issues.
What do you get out of the work that you do with Extinction Rebellion?
It's all, you know, community is really, yeah, really great, but it's also really good relief for my climate anxiety. Mm. I have so much existential dread at all times, but working on things, even as simple as writing the newsletter and forcing myself to read the, you know, this week's climate news, even though I know it's going to be very scary, really does so much to help me with my climate anxiety. And it's connected me to an incredible network of people all across the United States who feel the same way that I do and who are worried about the future as well and want to do something creative and interesting and fun to get that immediate action. So, I mean, of course I get that relief, but, I think it also builds confidence. Like I was mm-hmm. saying earlier, like, I know that we can do this. We can absolutely do this. It's just really, really daunting, but it builds the confidence that I know that we can see a better world, and we will.
I saw on the Extinction Rebellion website about an upcoming meditation and discussion session, and it says on the website that it's a peer-led exploration about how Buddhism, meditation, and other practices can help us respond to the climate emergency. Can you share some information about that?
Yeah, so I think contemplative practices can really allow us to make it through tough challenges. Taking time to introspect, especially when done in community, can really give you perspective both on how much you're able to do personally, but also how much of this is not your burden to bear, how much of this is not your fault. So yeah, especially in community, because a lot of those can also be places for, outside of the introspection, ways to build stories and share stories about experiences. And a huge strength through that is that not only are those stories motivating, but they can also help guide morals. So especially when you're in a nonviolent movement, having contemplative practice allows for that sort of back and forth of where do we belong in this movement, and how much do we need to do, and how much can we do, and who else has done this, and really gives time to soothe anxiety and build community.
So what are your suggestions about if a person's listening to the show and they're thinking about getting involved in some kind of environmental issue, maybe more specifically with Extinction Rebellion? What are your suggestions about how they go about deciding what to do, how to get involved?
Well, I guess before that, I would say that if you're listening to the show right now, it's really important that you know that you matter. Really, your politics, none of that matters, but you as a person, you really, really matter. Just as a human being, you are really, really important. And with that, you have the power to make change. Even though we are in a broken democracy, we're in this crisis of democracy, we still do have a little bit of democracy left. Your voice does matter. If you've been disenfranchised, if you feel ignored by your institutions, I empathize with you, and that's very real, but you are really important. And if you want to get involved, then there's a couple things you can do. You can go to xrus.org, and they'll give you a list of a bunch of chapters. You can Google Extinction Rebellion Asheville. I'm pretty sure that it would make sense for there to be an XR Asheville for sure. You're welcome to reach out. I don't know if it's appropriate for me to give an email here, and I can connect you as well. And if you're interested in just like climate activism in general, but this doesn't sound like it's what you want to do, that's totally fine. Again, you can even reach out to people in XR and ask for alternatives. They would be happy to connect you to anything. But we need everybody in the movement. We need every voice in the movement. We need you, anybody listening in the movement, because I guarantee you, whatever you think other people have at stake, you have at stake as well. We are all going to be facing the effects of food insecurity here in the future. Some people are going to be facing it much, much worse than others. And so we need to come together and build community, especially right now when we have so little community and social support in our country, more than ever. So don't despair, don't give up. You matter, even if it's having conversations with your friends about anything you heard or anything you care about, or sharing your fears. Everything's important.
We've come to the end of another show, and our guest has been Riley Polka, climate activist and organizer with Extinction Rebellion DC. Riley, I want to thank you for the work you do with Extinction Rebellion, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. You as well.
You've been listening to A Better World on 103.7 WPVM. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out this week with Patti Smith singing People Have the Power. Thank you.
listening to WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7 on your dial, and global.